Buongiorno a tutti.
Good morning. Annalisa Bianco, I'm art director. I'm here first of all to thank you on behalf of Alisa Pisti, who is the actress who will be doing the reading, and Simona Paravicini, our technical coordinator. I just take a few minutes to brief you in on this reading. It is, of course, an adaptation of an African novel. The author is Amadou Kourouma, born in 1927 in Ivory Coast. He died in Lyon in 2003. He wrote many books, all translated into Italian. And in 2001, he was awarded the Green Sun Award. We have a true passion for African literature, and this is the second time that we cooperate with, we have this partnership with Médecins Sans Frontières. Some years ago, you have supported a performance of ours that was taken from an interview book, interviewer book, Fabrizio Gatti, who wrote a reportage on a trip in Africa, where he managed to be captured and apprehended in a camp, a refugee camp. The title is Lavorare, Morire as da Clandestini, Travel and Die as Refugees. This is our second partnership with you. The second book, and the title being Allah is Not Obliged, and is these are two books that have been translated into Italian. This in particular lends itself to be performed. So this is a child that is speaking, a 12-year-old child. Ira Imi is his name. He was born in Western Africa. And of course, he has some problems to start with, but these problems become even get worse because he's forced to start his this trip. This journey, along the western part of Africa, and at the end slowly becomes a child soldier with lucidity and with a clarity that is that of the author, of course, who wrote the book. But he, of course, the author tries to maintain the childish perspective on into the world as he grows and as he starts this experience. So thank you, and I wish you, I hope you will enjoy the reading. My name is Birahima. I'm an African petit nègre. If you speak broken French, you are a petit nègre, even if you are grown up or old. And this applies to Arabs, Chinese, white people, Russians, even Americans. Always petit nègre. I'm neither nice nor handsome, and perhaps I talk too much. And now I'm going to tell you my story. Before arriving in Liberia, I was a knight in shining armor, as it were, a street child. But before being a street child, I used to go to school. And before going to school, I was an uncircumcised child. I ran through the fields, along the creeks. I would chase mice and birds, a true black African child living in the bush. And before that, I would crawl about my mother's heart, and before that I was inside my mother's belly, and even before that maybe I was a snake or a fish. One must have been a snake, a tree, an animal, a man or a woman before entering the mother's belly. Ah, wait. I must tell you a very important thing. The important thing I must tell you is that my mother moved about on her buttocks, on both buttocks, mind you. Her left leg was... Wait a minute. The left leg was thin, so thin, like a stick, and her right leg was a stump, eaten up by an ulcer. My mother would jump on her buttocks like a caterpillar. I would run on all fours, and she would chase me, but I was too quick for her. So, when I was little, there was an ulcer that ate my mother's leg, because Allah is not obliged to be just in all the things he does on earth. And then there was me, that I used to roll around on all fours in the hut, and I would trip over the ulcer, and the pain would make my mother scream. Ooh! She would scream like a hyena whose paw was caught between the teeth of a wolf trap, and she would cry, stop crying, stop crying, grandmother would say. Allah creates us with a given dose of luck, each. Eyes, height, and suffering. He gave you ulcer pain when you were born. We must repeat, Allah kubakaru, Allah kubakaru. Allah is great. He never gives pain without reason. He makes you suffer on this earth so that then you get eternal happiness. A mother would wipe her tears and pray with my grandmother. In the hut, there were all kinds of bad smells, farts, shit, pee, the stench of the ulcer, the smell of smoke, but it never felt like throwing up. Mother smells were all good. When my mother was young, a virgin and beautiful girl, used to live in a village where my grandfather trafficked in gold, and there were many outlaws who raped and slaughtered the girls who had not yet been excised. So my grandmother didn't wait long and sent her back to her village for the initiation ritual. But when they cut my mother, the blood wouldn't stop, and she was about to die. The sorceress, that mutilated the girls belonged to the Bambara. The Bambara are the natives, the real owners of the land. They don't believe in Allah like us, Melinka. They are savages and sorcerers, so many of them are bad. But the mutilating sorceress wasn't bad. She cured my mother with her magical art, and my mother stopped bleeding. My grandparents wanted to reward the sorceress, but she didn't want to accept anything. No way. She wanted my mother to marry her son, because my mother was really beautiful. But his son was an idolater, a disbeliever, a sorcerer. And a disbeliever cannot be given a pious Muslim as a wife. Everyone in the village said, no, no way. And my mother was married to the imam's son, my father. After that, the sorceress and her son got so angry, very angry, and they cast a spell on her right leg, my mother's right leg. So, while my mother was expecting my older sister, a little black spot appeared on her right leg, and it started to hurt. They punctured that black spot, and it became a wound. It was treated, but it didn't heal. The wound started to eat her foot and then her calf. They took her to the hospital, where there was a white doctor, an African doctor, a medical officer, and a midwife. The white doctor said that my mom's leg had to be amputated at the knee and the rotten part of the leg thrown to the dogs. But luckily enough, grandfather had given a chicken to the medical officer, who came during the night to warn them. Your disease is not a white disease. It's the disease of a black wild person, and only an African healer can close the wound. If the white doctor operates on you, you will die. You will surely and completely die. So my grandfather paid a donkey owner and had my mom taken away from the hospital. But when they returned to the village, something incredible happened. Three old sorcerers from the village of the sorcerers had come there. They had come to ask my mom for forgiveness because the son of the sorcerers had died. He had died in a really terrible, horrific way. He had gone out to kill a buffalo in the bush, but the buffalo had rammed into him, slammed him here and there, and then threw him on the ground and trampled on him until he was utterly dead, with all these intestines and entrails in the mud. The sorcerer said that the buffalo was my mother's avatar, that my mother was the greatest witch in the world. She was the leader of all the sorcerers and soul eater, and every night she would eat souls and even the ulcer of her leg. That is why no one knew how to heal her putrefied ulcer. It was she herself, my mother, who wanted to walk on her buttocks all her life, because at night she enjoyed eating other people's souls and her own rotten wound. When I learned about this, I was so frightened and I was so disgusted that I cried. I cried for 4 days and four nights. And on the morning of the fourth day, I left the hut because I didn't want to eat with my mother anymore. It made me throw up. Grandma came looking for me, found me, wiped my tears, and told me that mother couldn't be a witch because my mother is a Muslim. But I was not entirely convinced. Once it's out, you can't catch a fart. And so, I didn't trust my mother anymore. But when my mother died, Grandma said she had not been eaten by the sorcerers, that it was Allah who had killed her with an ulcer and tears. Because Allah from heaven does what he wants. He is not obliged to set right the wrongs down here. From that day, I knew I had done something. I had heard my mother. Mother is now in heaven. She is no longer in pain. Everyone on earth is happy, except me. I was a bad kid with her, so I am cursed. Everywhere I go, for everything I do, I'm cursed.
Per il funerale della
My aunt Tahan came from Liberia for my mother's funeral. Mahan had fled to Liberia with her second husband because her first husband, my cousin Mamadou's father, was a great hunter who would yell and threaten people with his knife and rifle, and he would beat my aunt and threaten to kill her. So one day she ran away. But a woman is not supposed to leave her husband's bed, even if he beats her and threatens her. So her child were taken away from her, and the father got custody of them. But despite this, the great violent hunter kept looking for her and for her second husband, claiming that he would kill them like deer. This is why my aunt, her second husband, had to flee as far as they could from the French colonies such as Guinea and the Ivory Coast and went into hiding in Liberia, which is an American colony. But when my mom's funeral took place, the violent hunter wasn't in the village. He would be away for several months at a time in other countries where he could continue being violent and kill animals, to selling their meat. So my aunt was able to come back and help everyone and mourn my mother's death. So the family council came together and decided that my aunt would become my second mother and also my guardian. Aunt had to feed me, aunt had to feed me and clothe me, and only she had the right to beat me, insult me and educate me properly. They decided that I should go with her to Liberia, where I would start going to school. To convince me, my grandma said that in Liberia I would eat rice every day with meat and semolina, and every day, and so I gave in. My aunt and I started to make preparations to leave, but suddenly, one evening, all of a sudden, at the time of the fourth prayer, we heard terrible screams and gunshots. The whole village said the violent hunter had returned. My aunt wasted no time. She immediately ran into the bush, leaving me there. And 2 weeks later, when my aunt got back to her second husband in Liberia, my grandfather and grandmother began looking for a traveler who could take me to her. Then Yakuba offered to take me himself. Yakuba was a big shot. Now, he was from our village, but he had made a lot of money in Abidjan, Dakar, Bamako, Conakry, and also in Paris, New York, Rome. Yakuba offered to accompany me because he was also a banknote multiplier, someone who, in return for a handful of change, the next day he would give you a lot of CFA banknotes and also US dollars. Yakuba was a money multiplier and also a fortune teller and also an amulet maker. He had been told that in Liberia, where there were wars going on, money multipliers and fortune tellers and amulet makers earn a lot of money. American dollars. They made lots of money because in Liberia, the only people left there are the warlords and people who were very much afraid of dying. A warlord is a big shot who has killed so many people and is in the commander of the village full of people he can kill without trial. Yakuba was sure he could work with the warlord without the police breaking his balls, because the police are always breaking the balls to Yakuba for all the jobs he does. Yakuba came to see me one morning, took me aside, and shared a lot of secrets with me. He said that Liberia is a fantastic country. There's a job over there, it's a top-notch job. There's a big shot there. And then he told me a lot of things about Liberia, wonderful things. He said that there is a tribal war over there. Their street children, like me, become child soldiers. And child soldiers have everything you can think of. They have a Kalashnikov, a rifle invented by a Russian that shoots no stop. They have money, shoes, radios, caps, and even cars that they call 4x4. I wanted to leave immediately for Liberia. Immediately. I want to become a child soldier. I kept on repeating this word, child soldier, soldier, in bed, when I pooped, when I kept shouting, child soldier, child soldier. And so I left with Yakuba for Liberia, because in that country there is a tribal warfare and people are dying like flies. And amulet makers make money, lots of money. When someone says that there is a tribal war going on in a country, it means that the country has been split up among street bandits. Wealth has been split up. The territory has been split up. The people have been split up. They have split up everything, and there's nobody stopping them. Nobody stopped them from killing, even children and women. And the most amusing thing is that they try to expand their territory more and more and to make more and more profits. So I was going to Liberia with Yakuba, where there are four big street bandits: Doe, Taylor, Johnson, and Elagi Koroma, and then many little bandits. In all tribal wars, child soldiers are not paid. They kill people and grab what there is up for grabs. In all tribal wars, soldiers are not paid. They massacre people and take everything there is to take. Child soldiers and soldiers sell the things they take. And this is why in Liberia you can find everything at bargain prices. Gold at bargain prices, diamonds at bargain prices, TV sets, guns, Kalashnikovs, all at bargain prices. And this is why merchants who want to get rich come in droves to a country where everything is sold at bargain prices. They come with handfuls of rice, small bars of soap, bottles of gasoline, a few dollars or CFA francs. There is a great shortage of these things down there. They buy or trade goods at bargain prices and resell them in Guinea or in Ivory Coast at higher prices, much higher. And that is what big business is. When there is a tribal warfare in a country, you join the convoy. In Liberia, we join the convoy. In front and at the rear of the convoy, men armed to the teeth rode motorbikes to defend the convoy, because there are many small groups of outlaws that stop the convoys to rob them. Yakuba and myself also left for Liberia in a convoy with bikes in front of the and in the rear. A little boy, a real child, a little man, just barely a little man, the bike in front didn't stop immediately at the signal of that little man. Those on the motorbikes thought that they were highwaymen and shot the little boy. And that the child, the little man, the child soldier mowed down, lay on the ground, dead. There was a moment of silence, as before a storm. And then the surrounding forest began to spit out the tralala.
Gli uccelli della foresta.
The birds of the forest saw that things were getting rough and they all flew away. The tralala of the machine guns hit the motorcycles and the men riding them. The men riding the motorcycles were dead, completely dead, and the machine guns continued shooting and shooting. It was chaos. The bikes were burning, the bodies were riddled with bullets again and again, and there was blood, lots of blood everywhere. The blood wouldn't stop flowing. Well, things don't usually go this way. Usually, the bike and the whole convoy stop immediately at the signal of the little man. And everything goes well, very well. The child soldier argues very amicably with the security detail. Then he whistles once or twice. And at that point, a 4x4 camouflage with leaves drives out of the bush. It's full of kids, child soldiers. Kids this tall, child soldiers who act cool with their Kalashnikovs over their shoulders, all in paratrooper uniforms, which are so big for them and so big that they swim inside them. And there are also girl soldiers, few, but there are some. And they are the worst. They can put a live bee in an open eye. That's how bad they are. And child soldiers arrive also on foot and swarm all over the bus, arguing with the passengers as if they were old friends. The truck takes the lead of the convoy and drives it to the fortified camp of Colonel Papa Le Bon. Everything is unpacked, weighed, and estimated for customs fees, and lengthy discussions take place. And then you pay in kind with rice or cassava or with US dollars. And Colonel Papa Le Bon organizes an ecumenical mass. Many blessings are exchanged, and they say their goodbyes and go their separate ways. This is how things usually go, because Colonel Papa Le Bon is the representative, the preacher of the NPFL, the National Patriotic Front of Liberia, which is the movement of the bandit called Taylor. Colonel Papa Le Bon was in command of the whole region, and he collected customs duties in Zazor, and therefore he controlled the large traffic arriving from Guinea for the NPFL. He would do this on behalf of the NPFL, on behalf of his boss, Taylor, the bandit. But with us, things didn't go that way. After the ta-ta-ta-ta of the machine guns, all that could be heard was the ta-ta-ta-ta of the machine guns. And meanwhile, on the bus, we were all going crazy. The names of all the mains, of all the divinities were shouted out, of all the protectors of heaven and earth, and all this because the man in front had shot that child soldier. Eventually, another child appeared, another child soldier in a paratrooper's uniform, but it was a girl. She examined the work done by the machine guns. Well, well. And as if someone could get up. But everyone was dead. And so she whistled loudly. She whistled, and from all sides, from all over the place, child soldiers came out, all dressed up in the same way, showing off their Kalashnikovs. They surrounded us and yelling told us to get off the bus with our hands up. The child soldiers were very angry. First they tore off the jewels, the necklaces and earrings, and then the headdresses, the clothes, the shoes. And if they liked the underwear, they would take those too. All the naked passengers fled into the forest, covering their intimate parts with their hands. And when it was Yakuba's turn, he started to protest. And he says, "I, sorcerer, I, Grigri man." But the child soldiers gave him a shove and forced him to undress. He continued to protest, "I, sorcerer, I, Grigri man." And when they sent him into the forest, he came back, protesting all the while, "I, Grigri man." My turn came. And I, too, didn't remain silent. I immediately started whimpering, "Child soldier, child soldier, I, too, want to become a child soldier like you. I want to go to my aunt." They made me undress, and I continued to whimper, "Child soldier, child soldier." Then they ordered me to go into the forest as well, and I stayed there, whimpering, naked, with my bangle in the wind. One of the child soldiers pointed the Kalashnikov in my ass, and I shut up. Yakuba, too. So we were silent, standing there on the road like total morons. Another truck arrived out of the forest that made several trips back and forth to transport all of the loot they took from the truck, from the bus. On its last trip, it returned with Colonel Papa Le Bon. If you could have seen how he was dressed up. First of all, he had a colonel's chevron. Well, tribal warfare is like that. And then he was wearing a white cassock tied at the waist by a strip of black leather with black leather straps crisscrossed on the back and his chest. He wore a bishop's hat on his head and leaned on a stick with a cross on top of it. Colonel Papa Le Bon carried a Bible in his left hand and a Kalashnikov over his shoulder and on his white skirt to complete the picture. That's the way he was dressed always, day and night. Tribal warfare is like that. Colonel Papalebon made a gesture, and the dead child soldier was loaded onto the truck on a stretcher. Then the car started, and everyone else followed on foot. We too, we, Yakub and myself, were optimistic because a line, his immense goodness, never leaves a mouth he has created empty. The fortified camp was like all tribal war camps in Liberia. All around it, there was a fence of human skulls stuck on top of poles. The name of the dead soldier was Kid. His body was exposed for the rest of the day, and the crowd came and bent over the body, pretending to be sad. The colonel shot into the air with his Kalashnikov, and everyone shot into the air. The colonel sang, and everyone sang, repeating, "Kid, kid, kid." You should have seen them. They were truly a gang of idiots. Colonel Papalebon recounted the death of Captain Kidd. Then he said that not everyone in the convoy was killed. Only a few of them were killed. Because God says not to kill too much, to kill less. God says, when people hurt you, kill them less, but leave them as they came into the world. And so everything they had with them, everything that was in the convoy, had been taken. It was supposed to be given to Captain Kidd's parents, but since nobody knew them, everything was to be distributed fairly amongst all the child soldiers. And the child soldiers will sell what they were given and make dollars to buy hashish at will. People were upset and cried out, "Kid, kid, kid." Then the child soldiers lined up and shot their Kalashnikovs. They shot with their Kalashnikovs. That's all they can do. That's the only thing they know how to do. Shoot, shoot, shoot. And so now we were there in the village of Zazor. The village of Zazor comprised three districts. The upper district, which was where Papalebon was. In the upper district, there were offices, an arsenal, a temple, houses, and prisons. Then there was the district of the huts, of those who were born there. And the third was the refugees' place. The refugees were the most blessed in the village because they received food from everyone, from the High Commissioner for Refugees, the NGOs. But there they only accepted women, children under the age of 5, and the elderly. In other words, it's a rip-off. The colonel made fun of us after Captain Kidd's funeral. I was sent to the barracks of the child soldiers, and I was given a paratrooper uniform. You should have seen how it fit me. It hanged on all sides. Colonel Papalebon made a solemn ceremony, handed me a Kalashnikov, and appointed me lieutenant. Child soldiers were given degrees to make them feel great. We were all captains, commanders, colonels, and the lowest rank was lieutenant, mine. The colonel himself taught me to use the Kalashnikov, but it was easy. All you need to do is pull the trigger, and it does it on its own, and it kills, and it kills. The living fall like flies. And then Colonel Papalebon was very happy for having met Kyakuba. He was very happy to have a good Muslim Grigri man. "Well, what kind of amulets?" the colonel asked him. "Well, for all purposes," Yakuba replied. "Amulets also against bullets?" "Well, bullet protection is my forte." The colonel kissed him on the mouth and set him up in a house reserved for the big shots. Yakuba was delighted. He had everything he wanted, and above all, he could eat like a horse. In a jiffy, he made three amulets for the colonel. Great amulets. One for the morning, one for the afternoon, and one for the evening. Now Yakuba was rich, and he made amulets for every child soldier and for every soldier, and the amulets were expensive. I was given the most powerful one, and I got it for free. You should have seen how hard Colonel Papalebon worked, all day long. In the morning, he would inspect the guard posts, then he would enter the temple and officiate. Then he would personally distribute the daily wheat to the soldiers' wives. Then he would pronounce court sentences. Then he would go to the infirmary and preach to the sick, the crippled, and the unfortunate. And he preached so well, that many times a sick person would be seen throwing away his cane and shout, "I'm cured, I'm cured," and he would start walking normally. After the infirmary, Colonel Papalebon would take care of the military education of the child soldiers and also of the soldiers. Military education is the same as religious education. If you love the good Lord and Jesus Christ properly, the bullets won't hit you. They will kill all the others, because the good Lord only kills the bad, the idiots, the sinners, and the damned. Now, all this was done by Colonel Papalebon, he alone. Not to mention all the customs work, not to mention the exorcism sessions, not to mention the secret meetings, and not to mention all the papers that the colonel had to sign. Well, I really thought that the colonel deserved a good hangover some nights, but he never smoked hashish, not at all. The hashish was kept aside for the child soldiers to make them feel as strong as real soldiers. Well, they gave me some hashish, too. The first time I smoked it, I threw up. Then I got used to the effects, but then it gave me strength. It made me feel like a grown-up. And I also ate well, because they gave me the task of standing in the middle of the road at the end of the curves to stop the trucks. So now I am the ambush kid. But now we were moving away from Zazor. It was dawn. The sun had come out like a grasshopper, and it was slowly rising. And we had to be careful. We had to walk in small steps to make sure we didn't run into the NPFL soldiers. Because last night, something happened. Something huge. Colonel Papalebon was killed. He died. Even though he had the amulets on him, the soldiers shouted, "Papalebon is dead. He was killed. The colonel was killed. Killed." It was like the sound of a gong being hit, and hell broke out. All the prisoners fled, and those who wanted to leave. Many child soldiers wanted to leave to join the ULIMO, the Liberian Movement for Unity, because there the food was good and there was also a salary. And so everyone started looting and setting fire to everything. Then we left on foot in a hurry, loaded with loot, with two or even three Kalashnikovs each. And all this happened because that night the colonel had got drunk, drinking whiskey from the bottles that were in the luggage of the convoy. The colonel never smoked hashish. He kept that for the children to give them strength. But getting drunk, well, sometimes he would get drunk. Yakuba and I wanted to go to the ULIMO too, because my aunt was in the ULIMO territory. Now there were 37 of us, 16 child soldiers, 20 soldiers, and Yakuba. We were of many different ethnic groups, and that was a big problem, because the ULIMO only accept the Kran or the Garay. So everyone changed their name to a Kran name. Well, I had no problems because I'm a Malinke, and Malinke are always welcome because they're all smart guys. They change flags, they go with the tide. We were all loaded with weapons and ammunition, but very little food to eat. We told that the Ulema was very close, but that was not true. It was going to take at least 3 or 4 days. And with hashish, we're always hungry. And so we started to eat the fruits and roots and leaves. But Yakuba said that Allah, in his immense goodness, never leaves a mouth he has created empty. We all smoked hashish and chewed weed. But the one who did it most of all was Sarah, a girl soldier who is very beautiful, and she smokes as much hash as 10 people would. She is engaged to my friend Jantai, also called Hothead. Since we left Zazor, she and Hothead were always kissing each other. They stopped all the time to kiss and smoke. Kiss and smoke, kiss and smoke. And so, at a certain point, she was completely stoned. And at one point, she sat on the ground, saying she was tired, and saying that we had to stop, but we were in a hurry. We were hungry. We could not stop. And Hothead, you can see that Hothead loves Sarah very much, and he doesn't want to leave her there. So he tried to cheer her up and force her to follow us. Come on, Sarah, let's go. But she didn't want to budge. She got pissed off and started shooting at Hothead. But since she was totally stoned, luckily she missed him. But that made Hothead very angry, and he emptied his magazine on her legs and took away her Kalashnikov. She screamed like a slaughtered pig. And then Hothead became sad, very sad. We had to leave her there alone because she couldn't walk anymore, and Hothead was desperate. She cried out, "Mom, Mom, Mom." And so Hothead hugged her, burst into tears, and we left them there hugging and crying. But after a while, we saw Hothead catching up with us, crying all the while. He was desperate. He had to leave her there. He left her there alone because she could no longer walk. The carnivorous ants and the vultures were going to have a good party. So now I'll tell you her story, Sarah's story, and you're going to listen to it because Sarah was 12 and she deserved having her story told. Sarah was 5 years old when her mother, who sold rotten fish at the Monrovia market, was run over and killed by a car. Her father, who was a sailor and was never home, put her at the service of Mrs. Kokui. Mrs. Kokui was a merchant and had 5 children of her own. Sarah became her maid and also her banana seller. Mrs. Kokui was very strict. But one morning, a street child stole some bananas from Sarah and ran away. Mrs. Kokui got very angry. She blamed Sarah, saying that actually she had robbed her, so she gave her a beating and locked her up and didn't give her dinner. "Next time I'll hit you even harder and you'll be locked up for 2 days without eating." The next day, Sarah went out with her load of bananas, and the same kid came along with a gang of friends. They stole some bananas, and when Sarah ran after him, the kids took all the other bananas away too. Sarah cried all day long and decided to beg to make some money and pay back Mrs. Kokui. But motorists are not very generous, and so at night, when the night came, she found a place to sleep amongst the bundles of a shop porch. The next day, she thought that if she returned home, Mrs. Kokui would beat her up, and so she decided to stay on the streets. One day, a gentleman went up to her and introduced himself. He was very kind and gave her some sweets. So Sarah followed him towards the sheds far from the houses, and there the kind gentleman threw her on the ground and raped her. He was so rough that Sarah remained there on the ground as if dead. She was taken to the hospital. From there, she was sent to the nuns in an orphanage on the outskirts of Monrovia. She was there when the tribal war broke out in Liberia. Five nuns were massacred immediately, and the others fled without waiting for the children. She and four other friends, in order not to die of hunger, prostituted themselves before becoming child soldiers. Now she was there, and the carnivorous ants were going to have a really good party, a really good feast. All the villages that we were crossing were abandoned, completely abandoned. But at the entrance of one village, we saw two people who were running. So we set out in pursuit because that's how it's done. This is what tribal warfare is. When you see someone running, you always have to hunt them down because there's surely someone who wants to hurt you. So we set out in pursuit, shooting like crazy. One of us, Captain Kick was a strange child. In fact, his name was Captain Kick the Crafty. He entered into the forest to capture them. Kick was smart. Suddenly, we heard an explosion and a cry. We all ran in that direction. Kick had stepped on a mine, and he screamed like a slaughtered calf. He called his mother. His right leg was almost detached. It was attached by a thread. It was a very sad thing to see. It's not nice to see a child in those conditions. A soldier who was with us and was also a nurse said that we had to amputate his leg. Three men were not enough to hold him down. Kick screamed like crazy, calling out to his mother. They cut his leg at the knee and threw it to the dogs. In the meantime, we were looking for something to eat. We caught, killed, and grilled all the animals we found, because Allah never leaves a mouth he has created empty. But then we had to leave. We have to leave. We had to leave Kick there. We left Captain Kick the smart one, to the villagers when they would return. Sarah had been abandoned to the wild beasts and to the insects, and Kick to the inhabitants of the village. Which of the two had the better luck? Certainly not Kick. This is what tribal warfare is about. Animals treat the wounded better than humans do. So now I'll tell you something also about Kick, because he was a really nice child and he too deserves some respect. In the village where Kick lived, tribal warfare arrived at 10 in the morning. The children were at school, their parents were home. Upon hearing the first gunshots, the children fled into the forest. Only the following morning, when there were no more noises, only then did the children decide to go home. Kick returned home and found his father slaughtered, his brother with his throat slit, his mother and sister raped and their heads smashed. All his relatives, close and distant relatives, were all dead. So what do you do when you no longer have anyone in the world and you're little? You don't have a father, a mother. You don't have any brothers or sisters. You're small. A small treasure in a country where everyone slits each other's throats. So what do you do? Well, of course, you become a child soldier. You become child soldiers so as to be able to eat and slit other people's throats. There's nothing else that can be done. Kick was smart. He took a shortcut and jumped on a mine. And we left him there to be lynched by the villagers. This is how Allah wanted Kik to end his days on earth. And Allah is not obliged to be just in all his things, in all creations, in everything he does here on earth.
Ulimo is the movement of those who have remained loyal to President Dictator Samuel Doe, the outlaw who was torn to pieces. Foreigners like us were not welcome at the Ulimo. We had memorized the story about Samuel Doe, his patriotism, his generosity, his sacrifice. They listened to our speech and then asked us for weapons. They brought a Quran, a Bible, and some amulets. We solemnly swore that none of us were going to become thieves because they already had enough thieves here in Senikil. They didn't want any more thieves, and then they locked us up in prisons, crick-crack. But when they learned that Yakuba was a Grigri man, they took us to the general staff, to General Barclay. General Barclay was a woman, and she was happy, very happy to have a Muslim Grigri man. I instead was sent off to join the child soldiers. Child soldiers in the Ulimo were treated well. They ate well and earned money as bodyguards of the gold miners. Dollars, lots of dollars. All the thieves of Liberia flocked to Senekiville because gold and diamonds are mined there. General Barclay was a fairly fair woman. She would shoot men and women alike, adults and children, and any thief who had stolen a pin or an ox. General Beckley's child soldiers were there to protect the gold miners who worked for the associated owners, who were the real owners of the mines. Without the associated owners, there would be no gold diggers, no mining operations, and therefore no money, no dollars. And that is why when two associate owners were kidnapped by outlaws who asked for a ransom, all the associate owners wanted to leave. General Barclay went crazy. Stay, stay. I'll go find them myself. I'll bring them back. They are Nyangbo. I know they are Nyangbo. Child soldiers are always high. But when they transferred us to go and attack Nyangbo, they didn't give us any hashish so that we wouldn't do too much bullshit along the way. But without being drugged, we were weak, limp as worms. We were all upset. We wouldn't stop asking for a smoke, but nothing for 2 days and two nights. But once we got to Nyambo, they set up camp and filled us with hashish so that we couldn't wait to fight because we felt as strong as bulls and we were sure that our amulets would protect us. We were the vanguard. Behind us was the regiment of soldiers and further back was General Barclay together with the sorcerers. The attack began at dawn. We crawled to the first huts and started shooting. But gunshots responded to our Kalashnikovs. The inhabitants and the soldiers of Nyangbo were waiting for us. It was no surprise attack. And so the children fell, one after the other. We retreated. Our dead were left on the ground. Then General Barclay said it was surely our fault, that we had certainly done something wrong, some bullshit, because our good luck charm hadn't worked. that we had eaten goat meat before the attack, and this is something we must not do when we are wearing our war amulets. Do you realize? That was why the child soldiers had died, for the goat meat. But what a bullshit. What a gigantic bullshit. And General Beckley believed this 100%. Then, tired of hearing those bullshits, Hothead suddenly advanced towards the first huts. He advanced, strafing like crazy, without stopping, firing as crazy. You would have seen it to believe it. He advanced through the gunshots with cold blood, with balls all covered in amulets, and the gunner on the other side dropped their weapons. They were afraid of him. They were afraid of his amulets, and they fled. Then all together we attacked the first huts, screaming like crazy, and the inhabitants came out of the huts with raised hands and white flags. All this thanks to Hothead and his courage. As soon as they saw him, they all were frightened. They buried the dead children in a mass grave and fired the Kalashnikov. When you are fighting, there are no funerals for the dead. And this set me thinking, I couldn't understand a thing in this story anymore. I started to have doubts about this world of shit. Hothead conquered Ningbo with his amulets. Was his story true or not? Who could give me an answer? So, was the amulet true? Was it a lie? Or as a scam? A scam as long as white as the whole of Africa. Yakuba and myself continued southwards because Aunt Mahan had gone that way. But to survive, we had our Kalashnikov and the certainty that Allah never leaves a mouth he has created empty. Birahima, the knight in shiny armor, and Yakuba, the amulet maker, and myself were headed south when we met Seku, one of Yakuba's friends. How is the cousin of your brother's sister-in-law, blah, 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 and then for hours and hours on end. Of all these greetings, Yakuba's greeting, he said he had met Aunt Maham, who was traveling on foot towards Sierra Leone. And then he came out with something wonderful. He knew for sure that everyone in the entire universe have had enough of seeing in Liberia indigenous black African Negroes slaughter each other like wild beasts. The whole world is sick and tired of seeing what the street outlaws who have taken over pieces of Liberia are doing. And people are saying, enough, enough. They addressed to the United Nations, and United Nations asked the CDEAO, which is the Community of Western African States, to intervene. And what did the CDEAO do? They asked Nigeria to apply humanitarian interference in Liberia. Humanitarian interference is the right that states are given to send their soldiers into another state to kill the people there in their homes, in their country, in their huts, on their own mats. And since Nigeria is full of soldiers, and they no longer know what to do with them, then it sent a large number of soldiers to Liberia who can massacre everyone. including civilian population. Nigerian troops are called interposition troops of ECOMOG. So now ECOMOG troops are in Liberia and in Sierra Leone as well. And they massacre people as they see it fit. When Yakuba and myself arrived at Prince Johnson's partisans' camp, we found it bordered by human skulls planted on poles, like all tribal war camps. Prince Johnson is Liberia's third street outlaw, but he has great principles because he's a man of the church. Prince Johnson is a brave man, but he no longer knows how to feed his troops. And so what? So let's attack first on NPFL post first. A powerful attack with powerful grenades, cannons for days and days. And so also ECOMOG learned about this and they arrived. And when they arrived, they didn't go into detail to see who is wrong, who is right. They came and threw bombs in all directions. They killed more people in one day than had been killed in a week of fighting.
There was hardly anything left to eat. Some soldiers started to desert. And so Johnson decided to attack another city, one of those controlled by Ulema, where there were gold and diamond mines. And they did so with powerful means, grenades and mortars, for days and days and days, because the others resisted, until the interposition forces of the ECOMOG were informed, and they arrived, but did not even think for a moment to intervene. They didn't go into details, and when everything had been destroyed, when nothing moved anymore, the forces of ECOMOG stopped the slaughter. They collected the wounded and decided who had won. And they decided that Johnson had won, and so they could continue to exploit the mines. But now, everyone had fled the region, and no one wanted to go back. The associate owners didn't want to go back. And without the associate owners, there was no mining, no duties, no dollars, no nothing. In short, nothing had been solved, and everyone was hungry and everyone was complaining. And this is how I, Birahima, the knight in shining armor, and Yakuba, the multiplier of banknotes, decided to go forward, to go ahead. And so we continued to look for my aunt Mahana. Yakuba and myself wanted to go west, but we had to go east. We were told that a truly extraordinary thing was happening. All the Africans, the indigenous wild blacks, and the racist black Americans of Liberia and the Creole blacks of Sierra Leone had all made an alliance against the Malinke. They wanted to kick them out of Liberia and Sierra Leone. They wanted to kick them out and slaughter them for racism. But a warlord from Liberia, who was Malinke, and his name was Elaji Karoma, had decided to save the Malinke. He grouped them all in the villages of the east. And so then we too set out towards the east and thought that surely also Aunt Mahan must have done the same thing. We hid our Kalashnikovs under our boo-boos. We covered ourselves with Yakuba's amulets, and I always held the Quran half open in my hand. And all the indigenous wild black niggers of Liberia who saw us pass were scared and got out of our way. So we traveled for 3 days through tribal warfare-stricken Liberia. On the fourth day, we arrived in the village of Woroso. Elihaji Karoma's camp was bordered by poles with human skulls stuck on top of them, like in any other tribal war, and child soldiers were on guard. We were about to greet them in Malinke, but we were immediately surrounded by soldiers, armed to the teeth, hands up. They disarmed us, they searched us up to our underpants and asked us to introduce ourselves one at a time. Yakuba went first. And he started to tell lies, huge lies, tall stories. You should have heard him. He said he used to be a Lieutenant Colonel Grigri man, and this was because he had done extraordinary things. He had neutralized the Ikhamog bombings. Everything that fired turned into water. Everything that the Ikhamog fired turned into water. The Ikhamog grenades were useless. They'd never exploded. He had bewitched an entire army. The army and all its war machines. And there was even more. He himself had made all the child soldiers and all the soldiers invisible. And those of the Ikhamog fired into the void. They couldn't see anything. After the lies told by Yakuba, I too wanted to ride the high horse. I too said that I had the rank of commander of child soldiers. I was the best of spies, and I had reached the chief of staff of Ikhamog, and I stole their maps, all of them. So the Ikhamog would bomb, have to bind blindly. Then I put a laxative in the whiskey of the Ikhamog chief of staff who got the shits. Then I went into where they kept their food, and I poisoned the food, and the Ikhamog soldiers would die like flies. They thought it was an epidemic and stopped the bombing. In the end, the soldiers of El Hadji Karoma understood that we are real Malinke and not Giyo or Kranz who came to spy on them, and they welcomed us. We are patriots, and the great patriotic army of the Generalissimo El Hadji Karoma needed officers of our caliber. But the food was bad at El Hadji Karoma. There wasn't enough rice. Well, to be honest, there wasn't any at all. The entire system was based on the exploitation of the refugees, on the NGO scam. We, the troops, forcibly restrained the Malinke refugees and then demanded from the NGOs that the supplies for them were to be handed over to us. Whenever the NGOs showed up at the gate with rice and medicine, some poor, well-instructed refugee would talk to them. Why don't you trust our brothers who have saved our lives? Everything you give them, they give us. We refuse any donation that does not go through our brothers. And the NGOs bought this. But what is most incredible, well, it happened after 3 months. Yes, because after 3 months, one day, we found Aunt Mahan in the camp. Aunt Mahan was happy to see me. And I thought that finally, she, Yakub, and myself would go together to some place where there isn't all this mess, all this shit about people who can't eat if they don't kill like wild beasts, and even worse. But when she arrived at the camp, she was sick. She had malaria and was running a high fever. When she arrived at the camp, there was a boycott. All the Malinkes boycotted the NGOs that refused to collaborate with El Hadji Karoma, their savior. NGO stretcher bearers came to take the seriously ill to a health center. But Aunt Mahan refused to go. She refused out of solidarity with all the refugees in the camp. She lay down for 3 days and eventually kicked the bucket like a dog. They threw her into the mass grave. May Allah have mercy on her. But in the end, my aunt and I had met. It was Allah who willed this, that His will be done on earth and in heaven. we crouched at the mass grave to pray. I, Birahima, the knight in shining armor, and Yakuba, the banknote multiplier. Yakuba prayed with such a pure and distinct voice that his prayers certainly went straight up to heaven. But maybe no one will listen to them because they're crouched around at that mass grave. There are two street bandits, myself and Yakuba. And I have killed many people. I have taken drugs, and I also made my mother suffer. And I think that our prayers, they cannot be accepted by Allah. No. It will be necessary to pray other prayers with other imams, many other prayers, so that my aunt's soul can rest in peace. Well, yes, that's the way it is. Because Allah is not obliged to be just in all the things that He does on this earth. No.
Annalisa Bianco, grazie, la regia.
Annalisa Bianco, thank you. Thanks to Simona Parolino, who was in charge of the technical aspects. I didn't greet you earlier on, so I thank you. I greet you now and thank you for having been with us, for having told us this story. And I thank the organizers that invited us. And now I pass the floor to someone else. Monica is coming to take the floor. Thank you.
Grazie a te.
Bene, buongiorno.
Well, good morning to everyone. I would like to invite the member of the board to join me on the stage, Ruggero and Fabrizio, attending remotely. So welcome to the forum 2022. What we do is important. Our actions are important, but what we say is important. This story, our stories are important. We have to speak to other parts of our body, not only to our ears. And I think the story that we just heard was a successful test. And some signs must have been left. So we hope. We were glad that some of the humanitarian people, staff, are here. So this is a time when all the various families of the movement come together and listen to each other. And we want to make the most of this meeting. So we I want to thank all the members of the humanitarian team, the group of voluntary people. I'd like to thank the member of the board, the general director, and all the official people. But most specifically, I'd like to thank two activists who are going to tell us about their experience, David and Lama, We will get to know them during these 2 days of meetings. Michael and David, who was sitting next to me. I would like to thank strongly, deeply, Fazil, who is the president of the Belgian Center. Thank you for being here. And also I'd like to thank Emain, the operational center from Bruxelles, who is attending remotely, and she will moderate, would be the moderator of one of the sessions. And also thank the organizers, of course, Annalisa, Virginia. So we are just at the at the beginning, but this will be repeated at the end. And I would like to thank Elisa, Simone, and Annalisa, who have been introduced us to start these 2 days of meetings where all the families of the movement can come together, and so that we take as much as possible from each other, so we learn from what other people do and also from what other people think and say. So I would like to give the floor to other members of the board. I just want to say that I've been attending these meetings for 12 years now, but it's always beautiful. It's like going home. Every time I feel like going home. It's always beautiful to stay together. This is the best thing. Contamination is a nice concept. Let's exchange experience. Let's talk about what we do, and the purpose of this of our forum is to be together. Well, the word contamination right now has some implications that for which we have to be careful, but we understand the spirit behind this word. So those who are wearing masks do not want to be contaminated. I'm joking. Thank you. I think we are going to start a very constructive meeting. The beginning, the beginning was very spiritual and creative. So we, for the first time, we have some new protagonists. So we have the image of Mezza Sofortier on the streets. That's how I want to describe this. We will have Erastus later, the international representative of our link with the international unit. And then, of course, I must have forgotten someone. So we now break for lunch. Again, thank you, Elisa, thank you, Annalisa, and thank you, Simona.